Welcome to the Hadavar Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Hadavar Messianic Ministries Director Pastor Bob Morris will continue tracing the events in modern history that we call the Modern Zionist Movement. He will continue to examine the people and events that God used to bring about the modern state of Israel. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now, let's begin lesson number 7. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Let's continue our study in the history of the modern state, the history of modern Israel, the first regathering. We're beginning lesson 7 at this point. It's the year is 1900. Zionism, the World Zionist Organization, has been put together under the leadership of Theodor Herzl. And when we come to 1900, the 20th century, we see that the Fourth Zionist Congress was convened, and that it was a very dismal time for the Zionists. Things were not progressing very well at all. In 1901, there was a Fifth Zionist Congress. There, the Jewish National Fund was created. In 1902, Mizrahi was created. This was the one of the aspects of religious Zionism that got going. Then 1903, we came to a very critical time in the history of the Zionist movement with the East Africa proposal, the Uganda project that split the Zionist movement in half. The Sixth Zionist Congress occurred in 1903. I also talked about Vladimir Jabotinsky. He attended the Sixth Zionist Congress as a young man and was enthralled by Theodor Herzl. Eventually, he would become the single most charismatic figure after Herzl in Zionist history. In 1904, Theodor Herzl died. And in 1904, we also saw the beginning of the Second Aliyah. So now, at this point, we are at, 1905 was the Seventh Zionist Congress, which rejected the Uganda Project. 1906, the Hebrew High School was established in Jaffa, and David Ben-Gurion came into the country. In 1907, the Eighth Zionist Congress met with very little results. In 1909, the first kibbutz was constituted, Kibbutz Degania, at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee. That brought lesson 6 to an end. The year is 1909, and we want to look now at the formation of HaShomer, the formation of HaShomer. Now, the organization of HaShomer actually goes back a couple of years before 1909. 1907 is actually the time when HaShomer began to be conceived. In 1907, September, 10 young men gathered in the attic of Yitzhak Ben Zvi's rooming house in Jaffa. Israel Sochat addressed the group, and he reminded the group that the conquest of labor necessarily, as a necessity, embraced the idea of Jewish self-defense. It embraced the right of the Jewish community to self-defense. For several months, Sochat had been traveling throughout the Yishuv. He'd been entreating his fellow agricultural workers, his fellow farmers, to assume responsibility for guarding the land that they were plowing. It was unthinkable, he insisted, to maintain the practice of hiring Arab or Circassian guards to protect Jewish property or lives. This was no way to revive a nation. The future of the Jewish nation was at stake, he warned. If the Jewish community was capable of farming the land, they should be capable of defending the land. Then, in September of 1907, a program was drafted to form a secret society of Jewish watchmen. It was called Bar Giora, after the celebrated Jewish warrior of antiquity. The little Bar Giora group offered itself to Jewish villages as guards. They were very successful, and the demand soon outstripped the supply of guards. Additional watchmen were needed to offer protection in other places in the Yishuv. Now, to achieve that goal, Bar Giora was reincarnated under a new title, the title HaShomer, the Watchman. Now, there was a training program set up for the HaShomer candidates, and this training program was exceptionally rigorous for these new candidates. Candidates were drilled in night maneuvers, in scouting, in direction finding, and in conversational Arabic. Only a few were accepted into the society, and they were known to be exceptional horsemen. They were known to be crack shots with a rifle. They were mounted, they were armed, they were brawny, they were confident of bearing. They evoked respect among the Arabs. Well, the fame of HaShomer spread to Judea. Then it spread to the coastal plain. On the coastal plain, large capitalist plantation villages invited HaShomer to take charge of the watch, and few of the settlers ever regretted their choice of protection. Despite repeated Bedouin attacks, the Shomerim kept security very tight. By 1914, the Watchman's Guild operated 4 squads in Judea alone. They boasted 100 men throughout Jewish Palestine, all of them on instant call whenever danger threatened. By the eve of World War I, 1917, HaShomer's legend of valor had dramatically raised the morale of the Yishuv. Well, in 1909, we have another very significant event, the founding of Tel Aviv. In 1909, from Jaffa, a new suburb emerged that would ultimately be destined to become the metropolitan center of Jewish life in Israel. In 1909, construction began on the sand dunes outside of Jaffa's town limits. By 1914, a modest community had grown up, encompassing 139 houses and 1,419 Jewish inhabitants. The community was named Tel Aviv, Hill of Spring. The population reached 16,000 by 1924 and continued to explode beyond that. 5 years later, in 1929, the population was 46,000 Jewish people. And by 1939, the population had grown to 139,000 Jewish people. In 2000, the population was 350,000 Jewish people, the center of Jewish economic life in Israel. Begun in 1909, Tel Aviv. Let's move to 1911. 1911 saw the 10th Zionist Congress. 1914, World War I occurred. By 1914, the Zionist movement had grown to 127,000 shekel-paying members. In 1914, on the eve of World War I, practical Zionism, embracing both colonialization in Israel and cultural activity in the diaspora, had become a meaningful Jewish force worldwide. Let's move to 1915. For all its impressive progress, the Yishuv itself remained the most vulnerable component of the Zionist movement after the outbreak of World War I. Up until that time, the Yishuv Jews relied upon European countries to ensure their physical security. And now, with Turkey's entrance into the war, that assurance was gone. The dangers of Turkish rule became all too apparent due to an increase in government brutality and expulsions. Jewish people throughout the Yishuv hurriedly began packing for departure. By March 1915, some 10,000 had found asylum in Egypt. In Egypt, Vladimir Jabotinsky and a man named Joseph Trumpeldor were instrumental in creating a Jewish transportation unit to serve in the British Army. That unit was called the Zion Mule Corps and served briefly and honorably with the British forces during World War I. Unrecognized at that time by the British and by the Jewish community alike, unrecognized at that time, the Zion Mule Corps represented the first tentative step in developing English Zionist collaboration, a collaboration that would be very, very important in the establishment of the modern state of Israel. Let's move to 1916. and the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It was the outbreak of World War I that suddenly invested Palestine with a new importance in Allied military calculations. From then on, England based its Near Eastern policy on one central immutable criterion, and that was the security of the Suez Canal. To cope with any threat to the canal, military headquarters in Cairo devoted increasing attention to a new political strategy. This strategy was to mobilize the Ottoman Empire's restless subject peoples in a joint military effort against the Turks. In fact, the idea initially had been suggested by a distinguished Arab personality, the Emir Abdullah, the eldest son of Hussein, the Hashemite sheriff of Mecca and Medina. Even before the war, Abdullah had visited General Kitchener in Cairo to request British help in protecting his father's dynasty against its suspicious Ottoman overlords. In return for British support, it was understood that the Hashemite Arabs would join the Allied war effort against Turkey. Moreover, after the war, the newly established Arab government would seek the advice and guidance of Great Britain only. On this basis, the Arab revolt finally began in June of 1916 under the leadership of Hussein's second son, the Emir Faisal, and later with the help of such British liaison officers as T.E. Lawrence, the very famous Lawrence of Arabia. During the subsequent year and a half, the uprising of between 10,000 and 20,000 Arab irregulars played a major role in the British military effort against Turkish forces in Arabia and eastern Palestine. Britain had dutifully informed the French and Russian governments of its agreement with Sheriff Hussein. It was in January of 1916 that Sir Mark Sykes, the British representative, and Charles-François Georges Picot, the French emissary, reached a meeting of minds on the allocation of post-war spheres of influence in the Arab world. Britain would be invested with supervision over Arab territories encompassing the largest part of Mesopotamia, most of Transjordan, and southern Palestine. The French would exercise various degrees of influence over southern Turkey, Syria, northern Palestine, and the Mosul area of upper Mesopotamia. Militarily, Sinai and Palestine began to function increasingly as Britain's chosen battlefield against the Turks. The Sinai Peninsula offered a more direct and manageable invasion route toward the Ottoman countries. Once this plan of action was agreed upon by the Imperial General Command, in June of 1916, British military headquarters in Cairo set about organizing and equipping a 150,000-man Egyptian Expeditionary Force, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, in anticipation of a straight-line plunge into Palestine. The force was commanded by General Sir Edmund Allenby. Now we come to 1917 and the Balfour Declaration. At this time, as World War I progressed, Zionism had become well known among some British politicians and statesmen. In fact, the Fourth Zionist Congress had been held in London, and it had received considerable publicity. Anglo-Zionism was faring very well in England during 1914 and at the start of World War I. One reason for the quality of these Zionist activities lay in the character of the Zionists living in England at that time. Their acknowledged spokesman was Dr. Chaim Weizmann. He was 40 years old. He was a chemistry instructor in the University of Manchester. In March 1916, Weizmann was summoned to London to help solve the shortage of acetone, an ingredient in the naval explosive cordite. After 2 years of laboratory research, he accomplished the task of devising a special fermentation process. Now, during this period, the friendships Weizmann made in the highest levels of British government were firmly cemented. Weizmann's efforts as a Zionist were further strengthened by other advantages. One was the mystical veneration in which many devout Anglo-Saxon Protestants regarded the Old Testament traditions, the children of Israel, and particularly the Holy Land itself. Now, two of these devout men were Lloyd George and Arthur James Balfour. Lloyd George and Arthur James Balfour. These men possessed a lifelong interest in the Holy Land and its traditions. These men felt deeply Christianity's historic obligation to the Jewish community. Now, that debt was compounded by Weizmann's personal services to the Allied war effort. Against this background of Anglo-Zionist cordiality, Weizmann's allusions to a British protectorate over a Jewish homeland struck an increasing responsive chord among government officials. The moment of decisive reappraisal in Middle Eastern policy came in the last weeks of 1916, when Lloyd George and Balfour became Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary, respectively. The new government recognized that the Sykes-Picot Agreement was not an airtight guarantee for British interests in Palestine. Perhaps then, the Jews as a client people might be useful in opening a wedge for British domination, just as the Arabs were. Now, Sykes was the official who served as a marriage broker in the progressively intimate relationship between the British government and the Zionist leadership. Sykes met with Weizmann in February of 1917. He met on February 7th with Weizmann, and it had become Sykes' mission to wed Zionist and British interests at that time. Now, Balfour had been nurtured in the Old Testament, and he did extensive studies of Jewish history. And his knowledge of the Old Testament, his study of Jewish history, filled him with an inner remorse about Christendom's treatment of the Jewish community. He told Harold Nicholson in 1917, and I quote, "They have been exiled, scattered, and oppressed. If we can find them an asylum, a safe home, in their native land, then the full flowering of their genius will burst forth and propagate," end quote. Now, imperial self-interest obviously was the paramount reason for the government's calculations. But in Balfour's case, there's a genuine vein of biblical influence that unquestionably strengthened his commitment to the Jewish national home. On June 17, 1917, the British statesman urged the Zionists themselves to formulate an appropriate declaration. He said he would submit it to the War Cabinet with his endorsement. Well, Weizmann and his closest associates immediately prepared such a statement, and it was submitted on July 18, 1917. The declaration originally read, and I quote, "His Majesty's government accepts the principle that Palestine should be reconstituted as a national home of the Jewish people. His Majesty's government will use its best endeavors to secure achievement of this object and will discuss the necessary methods and means with the Zionist organization." End quote. Now, ironically, the only forceful opposition came from the one Jewish man in the Lloyd George government, Edwin Montague. Montague's opposition had an effect. The effect was not to change the mind of Balfour or Lloyd George or other Zionist sympathizers, but his opposition persuaded them that a milder text was needed. So the declaration was reworded. It was approved by the War Cabinet on October 31st, 1917. Very important date, October 31st, 1917. The Balfour Declaration now read, quote, "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. End quote. Lady Dugdale, Balfour's niece, wrote this, and I quote, "Near the end of his days, he said to me that on the whole he felt that what he had been able to do for the Jews had been the thing he looked back upon as most worth doing." End quote. Balfour told a friend in 1918, and I quote, "My personal hope is that the Jews will make good in Palestine and eventually found a Jewish state." End quote. In that same year, Lord Robert Cecil declared, and I quote, "Our wish is that Arabian countries shall be for the Arabs, Armenia for the Armenians, and Judea for the Jews." End quote. In 1920, Churchill, he served as Minister of Munitions when the Balfour Declaration was issued. In 1920, Churchill said this. He spoke of a, quote, "a Jewish state by the banks of the Jordan, which might comprise 3 to 4 million Jews." End quote. Well, with all this support, the Jewish community in England was thrilled and grateful. Now, when the news of the declaration reached Russia, it evoked wild rejoicing. Petitions and cables of gratitude flooded in on Balfour from Jewish communities as far removed as Shanghai, Alexandria, and Cape Town. Now, if the War Cabinet's major objective was to swing neutral Jewish opinion toward Britain, it succeeded beyond all expectations. Well, it was in October of 1917 that Allenby launched his invasion of Palestine. Augmented by tens of thousands of Commonwealth troops, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force struck quickly in the interior of the country. They overran Beersheba, they captured Jaffa on September 16th, and they finally took Jerusalem 3 weeks later. On December 11th, 1917, Allenby himself marched bareheaded into the historic capital to address a gathering of Muslim, Christian, and Jewish notables, which had been convened on the steps of the Tower of David. "We have come," he declared, "not as conquerors, but as deliverers. It is our intention to open a new era of brotherhood and peace in the Holy Land." Let's move on to 1918 and the end of World War I. Ultimately, when the British finally overran the last of the enemy's forces in September 1918, the Jewish population had been reduced from its pre-war figure of 85,000 to less than 55,000. The country had been starved by an Allied blockade. It had also been ravaged and ruined by Turkish forces. Scores of villages had been laid waste. Trees and orange groves were damaged. Public security had all but been extinguished. Now the British naturally gave their first and most urgent attention to food supplies. Allenby ordered them to be imported directly from Egypt. The American Near East Relief soon followed with shipments of clothing and medicines for the Christian and Muslim populations. The Zionist organization and Hadassah, the women's counterpart, matched these efforts for the Jewish community. In December 1917, the British Foreign Secretary approved the departure of a Zionist commission for Palestine to organize relief work and to supervise repair and damage of the Jewish colonies. The commission embarked for Israel in March of 1917. It was eventually given official status as an advisory body to the military government in all matters relating to the Jewish community. Now, at this point in time, no one raised any objections to a Jewish national home in the land of Israel. Please note that. At this point, no one had raised any objections to a Jewish national home in Israel. France rejected British and Zionist claims to the headwaters of the Jordan, but the French Prime Minister did not dream of challenging the notion of a Jewish national home. Neither did the Italian government. President Wilson remained firmly committed to the Balfour Declaration throughout the peace conference. He stated to Felix Frankfurter was a leading American Zionist, he stated this, quote, And so far, I have found no one who is seriously opposing the purpose for which it embodies. President Wilson had found no one who seriously opposed the Balfour Declaration. When entrusting Palestine to Britain, the Allied statesmen at the San Remo Peace Conference incorporated into their allocation award the verbatim text of the Balfour Declaration. And so the basic moral support of the Western governments was firmly established as a result. In the beginning, too, the friendship of the Hashemite Arab leadership seemed equally beyond question. In January 1918, after the Balfour Declaration was issued, Commander D.H. Hogarth, research director of the Arab Bureau in Cairo, was dispatched to Arabia to clarify for Hussein the implications of the Zionist program. Now, sensing the potential financial advantages of Arab-Jewish cooperation, Hussein was enthusiastic. Hussein issued the Jews several warmly phrased invitations to return to their, quote, sacred and beloved homeland. He was very enthusiastic at that time. At the end of the year, December 1918, Sykes brought Weizmann and Faisal together in London. Each expressed mutual understanding and support for each other's position. The discussions and courtesies between them were ultimately formalized in a document signed by both Weizmann and Faisal. It was a pact envisioning a common stance at the peace conference. The treaty was signed in January 4th of 1919. Now, as it turned out, Faisal expected Zionist diplomatic support against the French. When it became evident that Weizmann was unwilling to act independently of Britain, Faisal turned against the Zionists. By mid-1919, as a result, Faisal terminated his public meetings with the Zionists. The pact that he signed with the Zionists, envisioning a common stance at the peace conference, was not published. And the Zionists, respecting Faisal's wishes, withheld comment on it for many years. Faisal became increasingly disillusioned with the Zionist connection. He expected a different agenda from them. And so the emir chose now to envision the Jewish national home as merely a sub-province within an Arab kingdom. He said, "When some Zionists speak about Palestine becoming as Jewish as England is English, they are really speaking unreasonably." So he had changed his position very much. In late autumn of 1919, Faisal ceased public communication with the Zionist leadership altogether. His policy of invoking Jewish cooperation for Arab diplomatic purposes in Syria had failed. Remember, the French were in charge of Syria, and the Zionists refused to go against the French or criticize the French. They refused to, in any way, step outside of their agreement with Britain. And so Faisal, upset by this situation, failed to gain his diplomatic purposes in Syria. And he also, of course, and then therefore turned against the Zionists. 1919 and the Third Aliyah. There's a continuation of pogroms in the Ukraine and Poland. There's an abolishment of community organizations and Jewish institutions in Russia. Now, the population of the Yishuv had fallen to 55,000 by the end of World War World War I. There were still 55,000 Jewish people in Israel at that time, but it had dropped to 55,000, and the numbers were replenished almost immediately in 1919. And this influx of replenishment became known as the Third Aliyah. Jews poured in from Eastern Europe at the rate of 1,000 a month by 1920, and ultimately reached a goal of 37,000 newcomers, 37,000 immigrants between 1919 and 1923. Now, most of the immigrants were simultaneously fleeing revolution, counter-revolutionary pogroms, and civil wars. Many came under the illusion that a Jewish state was about to be established. But all of them, whatever the case, all of them regarded Eastern Europe, post-war Eastern Europe, as a dead end. Now, an unusually effective Zionist immigration organization sprang up at this time. It was allowed to function in Russia during the early 1920s. It was known as Hechalutz, the Pioneer. Hechalutz, the Pioneer. Now, the organization's formal training program in Russia infused the Third Aliyah with a practical dynamic that was unique in Zionist history. Their unique emphasis was pre-immigration agricultural training. The notion of advanced agricultural experience was first promoted widely by Joseph Trumpeldor. He returned to Russia from Israel in February of 1917. Trumpeldor urged Jewish youth to equip themselves in advance for the tasks ahead. They must train while still in Russia. They must cultivate the soil adjacent to their own villages. They must learn from the farmers about them. And to that end, he himself and a number of close associates traveled throughout Western Russia, organizing Chechalutz groups and establishing training centers. The response? Tens of thousands of young Jewish Russian men and women enthusiastically took up the study of agriculture. They studied agriculture on purchased or rented tracts, and they closely followed the advice of Jewish and occasionally Russian instructors. In 1921, a world Hechalutz organization was founded. In 1925, or by 1925, Hechalutz membership had reached 33,000, and by 1933, 83,000. As early as 1919, however, the first Hechalutz youngsters began arriving in the land of Israel itself. 1920. The British are granted the mandate over Israel. Now, this occurred gradually. It began in December of 1918. By December of 1918, 200,000 Commonwealth troops had planted the Union Jack in Syria, Western Turkey, Palestine, Mesopotamia, and Lower Iran. Palestine would then be awarded to Britain as a British mandate. Now, what in the world is a mandate, or the mandate? The mandate, by definition, is this. It's a commission from the League of Nations authorizing a member nation to administer a territory or a region. It's a commission from the League of Nations authorizing a member nation to administer a territory or a region. The purpose was to prepare and eventually release the territory for independent statehood. Now, the Supreme Council of the Peace Conference formally validated this understanding at San Remo, Italy, on April 25th, 1920. On the basis of exhaustive geographic and geological surveys, Weizmann and his Zionist colleagues asked the Supreme Council for a Palestine bounded in the north by the slopes of the Lebanon Mountains, the headwaters of the Jordan, and the crest of Mount Hermon. They asked for boundaries on the east to be the Transjordan Mesopotamian Desert, and on the south to be the Gulf of Aqaba. Well, the French were not prepared to accept these boundaries. But on December 4th, 1920, the British and French prime ministers reached a final understanding on the boundary issue. And the result was a country with artificial boundaries. They were boundaries that ignored historic Israel and deprived the country of the headwaters of the Jordan River. At this time, Tel Chai, has an important impact on the history of Israel. In August of 1919, Joseph Trumpeldor returned to Israel to arrange facilities for the influx of the Chaludzim. He lived in his kibbutz Tel Chai in Galilee. However, in 1919, fear and distrust of Zionist aims grew daily among the Arabs. Barbed Arab newspaper editorials began to appear. The Arabs made public threats, and there were instances of Arab unrest in towns. These instances of unrest grew month by month. In February of 1920, a party of Arab raiders attacked the Jewish colonies of Metula and Tel Chai along Israel's northern border. And among those who were killed defending the outposts was Joseph Trumpeldor. More ominously yet, it was the season of Nebi Musa, a traditional Arab counterpart to Easter and Passover, when devout Muslims travel in pilgrimage on the Jericho Road to the grave of Moses. The Arabs arrived in Jerusalem on April 4, 1920. Soon a large crowd gathered to hear a nationalist harangue by agitators. Not all of them were local. They extolled the name of Faisal. Their purpose was clearly to influence the Allies, who were scheduled to assign the mandates in San Remo within the next few days. Well, the crowd became unruly. The Arab police joined in the applause, and violence began. And during the next 3 hours, 160 Jews were wounded. Eventually, British troops arrived and quelled the disturbances. The next morning, however, the instigators, who had been detained overnight, were released, and attacks on the Jewish community promptly resumed. Order was not restored until the third day. By then, the number of Jewish people and Arabs who had been killed were a number had been killed, and several hundred were wounded. It was in San Remo, a day before the assignment of the mandates, that Herbert Samuel was informed of his selection by Lloyd George as Civil High Commissioner for Palestine. He was known to be a loyal Jew and a Zionist, and so this reputation seemed to emphasize the government's commitment to the Jewish national home. The appointment was not without its risks. Faisal regarded it as a provocation toward the Arabs. So did Allenby, who warned that violence would follow. But the misgivings and precautions soon appeared unwarranted. Most of Samuel's initial appointments aroused enthusiasm among the Jews and the Arabs alike. Now, the Zionists were particularly gratified by Samuel's firm open-door policy on immigration, and even Arab nationalists respected Samuel. However, this very impartiality proved to be the High Commissioner's Achilles heel. It was his obsession with fairness that influenced him to make conciliatory gestures to the Arabs. And far from satisfying Arab nationalism, these gestures only encouraged it. Arab restlessness throughout Palestine grew. Now, the Zionist organization was in disarray following World War I. The political machinery had ceased to function during the 4.5 years of hostilities. The central Zionist offices had remained in Germany, and the bulk of its membership in Russia. And Weizmann's stupendous coup of achieving the Balfour Declaration transformed London into the practical headquarters of Zionism. So it was Weizmann and his associates who convened a special conference of Zionist leaders in London in July of 1920. The London conference took upon itself to elect Weizmann as the president of the Zionist organization. At the London conference, Weizmann emphasized that the priority need in building the Jewish national home was knowledge, modern methods, and money. Those were the priority needs. For the purpose of gathering all important money, Weizmann and his colleagues on the Zionist Executive Committee authorized the establishment of a Keren HaYesod, a foundation fund, Keren HaYesod, a foundation fund to tap the resources of diaspora Jewry. Well, I can see our time for Lesson 7 here is quickly drawing to an end. So let's call this lesson to a close here in the middle of 1920, and we'll pick it up with lesson number 8 and the founding of the Histadrut.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Hadavar Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries. If you're listening to this class on audio tape, please turn the tape over to begin the next lesson. If you're listening to this class on CD, the next lesson will begin in a moment.